The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion, where we will explore the EB1 category, the employment-based first preference category. Joining me for today's discussion are my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, the brilliant Anna Stepanova, who's the head of that team, and Adam Rosen, whose knowledge and wealth of information are awe-inspiring. We truly have a rock star team discussing these options and talking about the latest trends here. So, of course, as you all know, the EB1A is for individuals of extraordinary ability, the EB1B for outstanding professors and researchers, and then the EB1C for multinational managers and executives. And so before we dive into asking Adam and Anna to explore some of these issues, just very, very briefly, the EB1A is meant for those who have risen to the very, very top of their field of endeavor. And it can be either, as we often joke, right, the Nobel Prize, a Pulitzer, an Olympic medal, or like most people, maybe trying to meet at least 3 out of the 10 regulatory criteria, which is lesser national awards, you know, maybe articles, media about the person, about the person's work, serving as a judge for others, those kinds of criteria and factors. And the best part about this is that most people love the fact that you do not need to have an employer sponsoring the EB1A category. It can be self-petitioned. And the other advantage is that both the priority dates tend to become current faster, and that way the person waits for less time to be eligible to get the green card category. And so before we do that, I know, Adam, you look like you're dying to share something.
I would love to. So before we get to the numbers, it's worth framing how this analysis actually works. Since the Kazarian decision, USCIS adjudicators apply a two-step approach. First, they are determining whether the petitioner satisfies the basic regulatory criteria, and then making a separate, what they call final merits determination about whether the record as a whole, everything you've submitted, demonstrates sustained claim. Excuse me. In my experience, the first step is relatively mechanical, but the second is where discretion creeps in, and that's where the most contested denials now originate.
So I know, Anna, you're our supervising attorney with that incredible team here that's been doing this for decades. So what trends are you seeing with the EB1A adjudications in light of this increased scrutiny?
Absolutely, Sheila. So USCIS has been applying this two-step analysis based on the framework that Adam just described, which was originally adopted from the decision in a matter of Kazarian. And the current trend is towards a lot more scrutiny, and particularly in the second step of the analysis, the so-called the final merits determination, where USCIS has a lot of discretion. And they are evaluate during the second stage in the analysis is whether all of the evidence, all of the documents of all of the professional accomplishments and achievements show that the petitioner is among that small percentage at the very top of their field. And there is not a secret formula that clearly shows that they're at the top of the field. So that is why it's subject to a lot of discretion. And in one of decisions issued by the Administrative Appeals Office that we're familiar with, USCIS recently affirmed the denial, even though the applicant and petitioner demonstrated that they met the regulatory threshold, the 3 criteria. Then, although there was no problem with that, but USCIS said that the evidence lacked what they say overall impact in the field. So impact is very, very important. And that shows how, you know, meeting the regulatory criteria may not be sufficient enough if USCIS downplays the petitioner's impact on the field as a whole. So this trend intensified very rapidly and sharply in the second half of the last year, 2025. Official USCIS data for the fourth quarter of that year shows that EB1A approval rate actually dropped to 53, just over 53%. And that is the lowest recorded approval rate in the recent years that we know about. But independent data from some private companies that watch this trend, specifically from the the company that's called Lawfully, which tracks real-time case outcomes for its users, showed that even, this decline was even steeper. And they said that the approval rate, according to their data, just went to 31% in September 2025. So this is concerning, of course, and more importantly than ever, the applicants are to file a very well-supported cases. All right. So it's interesting that in years 2024 in the year 2024, USCIS somewhat relaxed the requirements. They said that team awards are allowed. It doesn't matter if it was a single award or it was awarded to a team. Past memberships will count. And they also relaxed published material standards, but the approval rate still fell. And that actually underscores that the final merits analysis remains critical.
Thank you, Anna. And like you correctly said, there's been a huge increase in the number of EB1A petition filings by almost, 50% year over year in fiscal year 2025, and yet the standards continue to be higher and higher and higher, with approvals falling dramatically from 60%, 70%, 80% to 50% and now 30%. So I think RFEs, or requests for evidence, of course, we're all seeing those, are increasing greatly. So I know, Adam, you're, of course, our litigator, and I guess we could continue on and on with this whole category, because it's clearly very, very attractive for people with a huge backlog in priority date movement. But the importance of time, let's jump to the outstanding professor researcher EB1B category. What are the requirements?
So that's a good question, Sheila. So EB1B is for professors and researchers with a record of outstanding achievements in academia. They have to show at least 3 years of research or teaching experience and entering a permanent position at a university or a qualifying private research organization. So unlike EB1A, where you don't need a specific job offer, EB1B requires a specific job offer. The applicant has to meet at least two of six criteria, which include publications, citations, awards, and authorships. And this is another category that USCIS uses the two-step Kazarian analysis to assess eligibility for approval.
Okay, yeah. So one thing that we should flag at the outset is that these outstanding professor researchers category, the important criteria, of course, is international recognition, which is obviously a meaningfully higher standard than just competence in the field, or even very different from the EB1A extraordinary sustained national or international acclaim for extraordinary ability. So, Anna, what adjudication patterns are emerging in these outstanding professor researcher petitions?
Yes, so what we are seeing right now is increased scrutiny over the international recognition that you mentioned, so the international recognition requirement. USCIS often requires proof that the beneficiary is known beyond their immediate professional circle, or in a lot of cases that the easiest way to understand it is that you have to establish recognition beyond your employer, the entity that you're working for. Even when they have dozens or hundreds of citations and some other accomplishments.
Exactly. I was actually going to say part of it is probably the job offer, and the other part is not just a regular job offer, but tenured or tenure track professions in most cases for the teaching, for the outstanding professor category. And then for the researcher, it has to be a major employer with documented accomplishments where you're playing a critical role. So it's the employer and this person already hopefully establishing it. Also, because like you pointed out and we discussed earlier, Anna and Adam, they are looking at this huge number of self-petition right. filing increases, but not as many increases in the filing in because, you know, right. there's only a small percentage of people that file in this area, right?
Exactly, because if you're going for EB1, you're looking at EB1A instead of going to your employer for what is already a limited category of EB1B.
Okay. Being cognizant of the time, let's go next to the multinational managers or executives, what is referred to as the EB1C, sometimes called the MET category. What is the criteria for this?
So EB1C applies to people who worked in a managerial or executive role for a qualifying foreign employer for at least one of the past 3 years and are coming to the U.S. to work in a similar role. Now, the U.S. petitioner has to be a parent, subsidiary, or affiliate of the foreign company where this individual has earned their experience. An employment offer is required, and the beneficiary must truly perform managerial or executive-level duties, not just perform day-to-day operations.
Got it. And so I guess, Anna, what kind of trends or difficulties are you seeing in these types of cases?
It's connected to what Adam just explained. USCIS continues to challenge whether the beneficiary, the sponsored employee, is actually functioning at an executive or managerial level, not just performing day-to-day operations.
Okay. And so I think we've sort of gone over sort of a big picture of the three main categories, extraordinary ability, EB1A, EB1B, the outstanding professor, researcher, and the EB1C, the multinational executive manager. So now let's cut across some big themes and big ideas. So Anna, if you could jump in. So which categories require a job offer, a sponsoring employer, a petitioner, which for which it, is it not essential?
The main difference between EB1A on the one hand and EB1B and EB1C, just to recap, as we've already mentioned, EB1A does not require sponsorship by an employer, can be a self-petition, usually self-petition. Once in a while, we do see that some EB1A petitions have an employer file them, but that's not the norm. And EB1B and EB1C, on the other hand, do require a U.S. employer to file the petition. That's primary difference between those categories.
Perfect. And yes, and as we had sort of also briefly mentioned during our discussion, EB1 categories generally tend to be closer to the current priority date, leaving out like countries like India, which sometimes, you know, have sometimes months, if not years, backlogs. But even then, it's well ahead compared to other EB2 or EB3 categories, right, that we've seen. So I guess, Adam, what's the role of priority dates in EB1 today? Are they still valuable or beneficial?
Oh, yes, of course. EB1 often remains current. And in recent years, we've seen retrogression for certain countries, especially India and China. Priority dates can affect eligibility for concurrent filing and adjustment of status, but it is still a valuable commodity to have an EB1 priority date. For individuals eligible under EB1A, there's a flexibility of self-petitioning combined with an early priority date. It could be a powerful strategic advantage. As of the June 2026 visa bulletin, India's EB1 final action date had retrogressed to December 15, 2022. China's was holding at April 1st, 2023, meaning neither country is currently current. In June 2026 alone, the State Department was forced to retrogress EB1 India by roughly 3.5 months because of the high demand and use of numbers. And the Department of State warned that further retrogressions or making the entire category unavailable might be necessary before the fiscal year ends on September 30th, 2026. So locking in an earlier priority date through timely filing an I-140 petition in the EB1 category is therefore more strategically important than ever for nationals of oversubscribed countries like India and China.
Yeah, so as you can see from our discussion today, you know, we've tried to highlight the main criteria, the what we're seeing on the ground, and how doing a strong, effective job to try to get an approval, understanding, an in-depth understanding of the law, of the regulations, of the policy guidance, of trends, of understanding case law, strategic presentation, documentation, and legal advocacy that's assertive and strong. And, you know, clearly, as I said earlier, we at the Murthy Law Firm continue to focus on strategy ideas. We cite relevant legal standards. We talk about the Administrative Procedure Act. We ensure complete and fair record and really work on how to present the best foot forward. And so I hope that our discussion today with Anna and Adam really helped you to understand where to plug in and how you can present the case. And hopefully we will have the honor and privilege at the Murthy Law Firm of guiding and helping you with the process, with your filing, on behalf of everyone at the Murthy Law Firm, including Anna, Adam, and myself. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and thank you for joining us today. Take care. Bye-bye.
Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.